Chapter 8. Selling the War. On Monday, September 16, 2002, I accompanied the president on a day trip to Davenport, Iowa. He planned to give a speech urging the Senate to pass the budget with full funding for important priorities while exercising fiscal restraint elsewhere. As deputy White House press secretary, I was filling in for Ari Fleischer, who had decided to take a break from the presidential roadshow. While his message of the day was on fiscal discipline, the president continued to discuss Iraq, echoing what he had said before the United Nations General Assembly in New York 4 days earlier. The UN speech signaled the beginning of a stepped-up effort in the administration's carefully scripted campaign to win broad public support for a possible military confrontation. The president outlined the case against Saddam Hussein's regime, its brutal repression of Iraqi citizens, its deceptive and willful disregard of UN Security Council resolutions demanding elimination of its chemical and biological weapons, its interest in developing nuclear weapons, and its support for terrorism. Bush asserted that all these actions made the Iraqi regime a grave and gathering danger that could no longer be ignored in a post-9/11 world. Then he unambiguously stated his intentions, rooted in a policy that had been determined months earlier. My nation will work with the UN Security Council to meet our common challenge. If Iraq's regime defies us again, the world must move deliberately, decisively, to hold Iraq to account. We will work with the UN Security Council for the necessary resolutions. But the purposes of the United States should not be doubted. The Security Council resolutions will be enforced. The just demands of peace and security will be met, or action will be unavoidable, and a regime that has lost its legitimacy will also lose its power. In a White House that prided itself on message discipline, Bush's speech provided the new talking points for educating the public about the threat, as we described our campaign to sell the war. The president, his national security team, and his other top advisors had used the UN forum as an opportunity to articulate the severity of the threat and the urgency of addressing it. They probably knew it was unlikely that international pressure could force Saddam Hussein to voluntarily come clean, which is why Cheney saw the UN route as needless. The only time that Saddam had done so was in the face of an overwhelming military defeat after the Persian Gulf War of 1991. But most recognized the need to show the public that diplomatic efforts were exhausted before launching a war. Hence, the ultimatum by Bush: either the UN act without delay and with zero tolerance for further deception by the Iraqi regime, or the United States would lead a military effort to do it his way. The public opinion climate at the time favored the White House, since 9/11 remained fresh in the minds of Americans. A week earlier, in a primetime address from Ellis Island, the president had commemorated the first anniversary of 9/11 in a magnificent display of stagecraft, with a Statue of Liberty over one shoulder and a waving American flag over the other. The president talked about answering history's call to spread freedom and alluded to Iraq, saying, "We will not allow any terrorist or tyrant to threaten civilization with weapons of mass murder. Now and in the future, Americans will live as free people, not in fear, and never at the mercy of any foreign plot or power." Of course, not all Americans supported the idea of confronting Iraq. Support for ousting Saddam Hussein militarily had peaked at 74% back in November 2001. By the end of summer 2002, amid expressions of concern among U.S. allies and military analysts about the potential cost of an invasion in terms of troops and money, that support had fallen to a slim majority, according to a Gallup poll sponsored by USA Today. But more than 8 in 10 Americans believed the regime of Saddam Hussein supported terrorist organizations intent on attacking America, and more than 9 in 10 believed it possessed or was developing WMD. A majority also believed, erroneously, that Saddam Hussein had been involved in the 9/11 attacks. Other elements in the political equation also strengthened the president's hand. Bush's public approval rating had declined from its unsustainable high of 90% immediately after the 9/11 attacks, but it was still strong in the mid-60s. The Bush campaign machine had a highly regarded team of national security advisors to call on in Cheney, Powell, Rumsfeld, and Rice, all of whom had seen their stature enhanced following the initial swift success in Afghanistan. What's more, with the midterm elections less than 2 months away, members of Congress, particularly those in moderate to conservative-leaning districts or states, would have been hard-pressed to oppose the Bush team's harder-line post-9/11 mindset. For at least some Democrats, including those with future presidential aspirations, opposing efforts by the Bush White House to confront Saddam Hussein seemed to pose far greater political risk than going along with its approach, particularly in an environment where Americans, concerned about future attacks, supported a tougher approach on matters of national security. So conditions looked favorable for the Bush team as it launched its campaign to convince Americans that war with Iraq was inevitable and necessary. The script had been finalized with great care over the summer, and now, September 2002, was the time to begin carrying it out. As Andy Card had told the New York Times just days earlier, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. But on the day of the president's trip to Iowa, the administration's well-oiled message machine sputtered audibly. That morning, the Wall Street Journal ran a story quoting Bush's chief economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, offering an analytical opinion as to the cost of a possible war with Iraq, somewhere between $100 and $200 billion. He added that this cost would probably have a relatively minor effect on the U.S. economy, since it would amount to only 1 to 2% of America's gross domestic product. I saw the story as soon as I reached the office, since the journal was one of the papers Ari had assigned me to read as part of a system he'd set up to make sure that someone on the press staff read each of the major national newspapers first thing each morning. It served in part as an early warning system so that the press secretary, or his deputy, would know what matters to discuss with senior staff at the morning meeting, and nothing blindsided him at the briefing. Lindsey's figures were eye-opening. It's a bit ironic. Looking at these numbers from today's perspective, with the Iraq War having lasted 5 years and counting, they look comfortably low, though Lindsey assumed the cost would be for a war of shorter duration. But at the time, when many, especially within the administration, expected a relatively quick and easy war, followed by a fairly smooth transition funded largely by Iraqi oil, they seemed high. But Lindsey's biggest mistake wasn't the size of the figures he chose to cite. It was citing any figures at all. Talking about the projected cost of a potential war wasn't part of the script, especially not when the White House was in the crucial early stages of building broad public support. In fact, none of the possible unpleasant consequences of war, casualties, economic effects, geopolitical risk, diplomatic repercussions, were part of the message. We were in campaign mode now, just as we had been when Bush traveled the country leading the effort to pass tax cuts and education reforms. This first stage was all about convincing the public that the threat was serious and needed addressing without delay. Citing or discussing potential cost, financial or human, only played into the arguments our critics and opponents of war were raising. Lindsey had violated the first rule of the disciplined, on-message Bush White House. Don't make news unless you're authorized to do so. Lindsey's transgression could only make the war harder to sell. Coming on a day when Bush was focused on the importance of fiscal restraint, it also gave the Democrats a way to brand the president's message as hypocritical. As soon as I read the paper, I knew that no one in the White House would be happy, least of all the president. I brought the story to the attention of others on the communications team and made sure that other senior staffers, including Andy Card, got the news as well. The morning press gaggle aboard Air Force One en route to Iowa confirmed that Larry's estimates were drawing a lot of media interest. I brushed aside the questions by saying it was too early to speculate about a decision the president had yet to make, but I understood the story was being played as a big news item in Washington. I knew reporters would want Bush's comment if they could get it. I had to warn him.